طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the mainstream media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. We have another doubleheader for you this morning, two presentations from the same forum at a conference sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. You will hear first from Virginia Tilley, professor at Southern Illinois University, address the issue of Israeli apartheid, and then Palestinian attorney Nora Erekat weighs in on Israel's machinations as it desperately and unsuccessfully tries to make what is illegal under international law legal. They try, they fail. We begin with Janet McMahon introducing Professor Virginia Tilley.
So as a result of last century's two world wars, the majority of the world's countries committed themselves to the principle of international law, which was embodied in the United Nations. But adherence to that principle and to the institution has not been guaranteed, and in some cases has been outright undermined. Our first speaker, Dr. Virginia Tilley, is a professor of political science at Southern Illinois University. She earned her MA and PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an MA from Georgetown's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. She has conducted research in Central America, Israel, Palestine, post-apartheid South Africa, and Oceania. She is the author of The One-State Solution, a pragmatic analysis of the two-state solution in Israel, Palestine, and editor of Beyond Occupation, Apartheid, Colonialism, and International Law in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Dr. Tilley is also the co-author with Professor Richard Falk of a 2017 report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia titled Israeli Practices Towards the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Despite intense pressure from Israel and the US, the commission's chair, Rima Khalif, refused to withdraw the report and resigned in protest. The UN subsequently deleted the report from its website. Fortunately, however, we are about to benefit from the expertise which informed that report's findings. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Virginia Tilley.
Thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be here, especially in the somewhat daunting position of first speaker. I just have to set the tone. I'm not seeing my presentation quite yet. Maybe that could go on. There we go. In this presentation, I'm not actually going to talk too much about the findings of the report. We really did write that report for a broad, informed audience of concerned people, and it is not hard to read. I think you don't have to be a legal scholar to do it. So I'm going to briefly summarize the report itself and then talk about what I think is much more engaging at this point to me, which is the implications of the report, implications for diplomacy and conflict resolution in Israel-Palestine. So I was asked to address the question of, is the U.S. supporting an apartheid state in Israel-Palestine? Well, yes, it is, in short. It is an apartheid state. And by the way, there is no such thing in international law as apartheid state, but its practices are consistent with apartheid, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the deeper answer here is yes, and so are a lot of other people, including people who wouldn't think they are. And that's what I wanted to come to in regard to the implications of this finding for questions such as the two-state solution. Essentially, those seeking partition are endorsing an apartheid state, and that is a bit startling, so I want to get to that. And it raises this dilemma that if apartheid anywhere is inadmissible and destabilizing, it cannot comprise the basis for a just and stable peace. Now, this lifts us out of a question of whether you're pro-anybody, and simply if you're concerned about international peace and security, which apartheid is considered to be a threat to. So in this talk, again, I'm going to talk briefly about the analysis, the legal definition of apartheid, how it works, and why it requires Israel to sustain the occupation. This is a particular point I'd like to bring forth here, and then move on to the implications, and why it brings us directly to the question of reunification as the only viable mode of conflict resolution. So it is based on three sources. The first is my own book that I wrote narrowly on the question of whether Israel could be expected to withdraw from the occupied territories to allow a two-state solution. The second one was this really extraordinary experience of coordinating a team of international lawyers. I'm a political scientist, not an international lawyer, through a project supported by the South African government. I believe this is on the desk out there. It is a legal analysis. Any of you who are familiar with international law should find it rewarding. Others of you might find it a bit dense. And the third one, of course, is this wonderful experience I had, a privilege of working with Dr. Richard Falk on the UN report, which was mentioned already. And a lot of what I'm going to say here came out of that report, but a lot of what's in that report relied on the previous one, Beyond Occupation. So the deeper legal analysis for the UN report is to be found there. So what is apartheid? We very briefly, the report gets into this in detail. We use apartheid very broadly. People, anything that sort of strikes us as racist or segregationist maybe elicit this term. That's perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. We use terms anyway that are suggestive or useful for a particular analysis. But if we're going to argue that states are accountable under international law to act to end apartheid, then we must refer to the law which prescribes that obligation. That means we are brought to the relevant international law, and that is found in two major instruments, the International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The first definition is far larger, much more detailed, but it lists a series of acts, including segregation and reserves that I'll come to. But it says that these are only acts of apartheid under certain conditions. They have to fit certain overarching conditions. And those conditions include, they may be similar to practices in South Africa. This is a universal instrument. They do not have to be exactly the same. The point is whether they seek, they have these other qualities of the law, that they are, that these are acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination. That I call that the purpose clause. And that it involves racial groups, that and a systematic system of oppression, it is not just a random collection of discrete laws, but a comprehensive institutionalized system that distinguishes the apartheid. And the Rome Statute picks up on that by emphasizing, bringing in a new term, which is institutionalized regime. Political scientists get all flushed with pleasure when you talk about regimes because we have loads of theory about regimes. We start to feel a little bit more in familiar land. All these elements of the definition are satisfied in this case. The report, I refer you to the report on this. It is an institutionalized regime. It's a comprehensive system of laws that ensures Jewish national privileges. And I want to stress that hyphenated construction here, the idea that Jews are a nation and that as a people or a nation that they have this certain privileges. That it does include policies similar to South Africa, but any policy variation there would not disqualify them necessarily, but it's nonetheless quite suggestive that they do. It is a racial conflict according to international law, defining what is racial discrimination, which includes groups defined by descent. And in this case, the local construction of Jewishness and Palestinianness or Arabness is a descent groups. The key quality here which conveys special privileges to one group over another is postulations about their descent and therefore their rights to the land dating from antiquity, expressed particularly in the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, which has the status of constitutional law in Israeli law. I'm speaking kind of fast here about law, so if you're getting a little like the wind outside, it's not to worry. It's clarified in the report. And crucially, the purpose clause is satisfied, that there is this aim, this formal aim, to maintain Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We have a cluster of laws and policies on the books to look at to confirm that Israel has that purpose, if anyone was in doubt about it. So from a legal perspective, that is satisfied as well. What was more interesting to me when figuring out how Israel was pursuing its apartheid regime was the way it works, which is these crucial policy variations among four interwoven regimes, and by the domain, which domain referring here to a territorial, geographic entity, and a cluster of expectations, norms, rules, practices within that geographically defined ambit. The first domain being Palestinian citizens of Israel. Now, what matters here most is the right to vote, because if you're going to have Jewish and democratic state, then it becomes important not to allow non-Jews to vote those laws out. That means that you have to constrain the vote. You can allow people to vote, but you can't allow them to vote on that point. And in order to do that, you have to make sure that the non-Jewish vote is never large enough to threaten those laws. So Palestinian citizens of Israel famously do have the vote, which is often cited as the crucial difference with South Africa, but they are not allowed to vote against their own minority status. They are not allowed to vote against the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, about 300,000 people, have no national vote. They can vote for the municipal government, but not for the national government, so they are carefully excised from that potential body of voters who could challenge the Jewish national character of Israel. Palestinians in the occupied territories, of course, have no vote. They are not citizens. And they can vote for the Palestinian Authority under the terms of Oslo, but they are carefully sequestered. 5+ million people are carefully pushed out of any possibility of joining an electoral bloc that could challenge this state. And Domain 4 is the Palestinian refugees outside of the country, outside of the territory under Israeli control, which is clearly, obviously, they don't have the vote. So another way to think of this is as a system. One regime that is effectively composed of four tailored sets of laws covering each population to achieve the same goal, which is to ensure that Israel remains a Jewish and democratic state. All kinds of arguments about whether you can be a Jewish and democratic state or a white and democratic state, I recognize that, but we don't have time to get into that now. What I would like to stress here is that this system requires that Israel maintain the occupation. Because if Israel does not keep the occupied territories under belligerent occupation, under military occupation, it faces the twin threat that a truly sovereign Palestinian state could form in those territories, which would then threaten Israel's capacity to prevent population mixing. Population mixing is the death knell for any racial state because the neat division of populations begins to go away. When you have people mixing, they make babies and it all falls down. On the other hand, annexation or full integration would require providing citizenship to the Palestinians, so that cannot be allowed either. Current talk about annexation is reflecting that dilemma, but it's better for Israel not to annex it. So what is the solution? Well, military occupation. So people say, well, we have to solve, we must put apartheid to one side in order to look at the occupation. I think you have that the other way around. One is the logic of occupation is following the logic of apartheid. So speeding right along, part two, implications for diplomacy. If apartheid, as it always does, it destabilizes the whole region, threatens international peace and security, it must be stopped on those grounds alone. It is morally untenable. It's a crime against humanity. It must be stopped, but how? The vision of two states is fatally flawed. My first book on the one-state solution got into this in some detail, just from a pragmatic point of view. I really only addressed that one thing. But it does mean that we cannot anticipate that Israel will withdraw. It's become emperor's new clothes kind of fantasy to think that that will happen. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. It requires a great deal of defense, and it fails. Sustaining Jewish statehood on the part of the territory, this is the crucial thing. If you partition the land in order to allow Israel to remain Israel in one part of it and a Palestinian state to form in the other part of it, you are basically saying apartheid will continue in that part where Israel is now composed. Saying Israel will continue to be a Jewish and democratic state, will continue to operate the way it is operating, it will continue to be an apartheid regime in a slightly different, modified border, within different borders. Now, my thought experiment, transplant that I did in South Africa, it would have been okay for white South Africans to sustain apartheid in part of the country and turn over the rest of it to black South Africans. No one entertained such an idea. It was anathema. This is the same thing here. You can't end apartheid by dividing the land and allowing it to continue in another part of the land. There's other aspects of this, but cutting to the chase, I would propose, therefore, that reunification is the only way to end apartheid. And since there's so many reasons to do that, we have to take that very seriously. For activism, and by activism I mean every kind of activism, from grassroots to legal activism and diplomatic activity and so forth, if you're going to end, and I just wanted to focus again on this angle of end the occupation. End the occupation is a mantra, it's a slogan, it's a sign people carry in marches, it's also a legal argument. But how? Again, Israel's withdrawal from the OPT cannot be anticipated. At best, it would be very partial. This is the Olmert plan, by the way, that you're looking at up here, where all the yellow would be Israel and the white would be Palestine, with a little umbilicus between the West Bank and Gaza. I mean, this is obviously an unviable state building. You couldn't control water, you couldn't control agriculture, you can't build a road that connects them, you can't, it's unworkable. Would not end apartheid. Establish a state of Palestine to leverage withdrawal. Now, this is a very popular movement right now, big diplomatic push in the United Nations to do this. However, my point here is that if we accept the apartheid analysis that this is an apartheid regime, then such a state would be a Bantustan. It would lack the attributions of true sovereignty. Israel, as long as it is composed as an apartheid regime, cannot accept any Palestinian state that is not a Bantustan, because any truly sovereign state would threaten the Jewish national character of Israel. This means that a Bantustan state, a state of Palestine formed under these conditions, would only secure Palestinian poverty, underdevelopment, frustration, insecurity, and essentially sustain the conflict itself. I'd like to just take an extra moment here, and I'm going to destroy my time constraint, I hope not, but I will pray that a little bit of extra attention to the bounty stands is worthwhile, and I frankly encourage everyone here to Google that and spend 15 minutes looking at the bounty stands a bit more than we sometimes do. I went to South Africa to study this material because I realized I didn't understand it, and I found it fascinating as a comparison to the Palestinian Authority and the territorial and institutional constraints that it's operating under. Let's just think through the logic. Apartheid imperative, the imperative of apartheid, wherever it would appear, would be to prevent racial mixing. Okay. Otherwise, the whole logic begins to fall apart. If you can't discreetly have different populations, there's nothing to defend. In order to do that, you need strict geographic segregation. This requires that you, if you're going to actually make this work, you need separate authorities within these territories. The South Africans, interestingly, called them black self-government authorities. And guess what Oslo called them? Palestinian self-government authority. It's a great deal of conversations between Israel and South Africa about the Bantu stands. It took a lot of lessons from it. I learned that from the diplomats in South Africa, by the way. This channels Palestinian or black or indigenous political aspirations to the local authority rather than to the state, to the dominant state. It's very convenient for an apartheid state to displace the frustrations and ambitions and the quest for rights of the population is dominating to their own leadership, operating under very tight constraints, of course. The pictures you're looking at on the top is a lineup of the Bantustan leaders in South Africa in the Bantustans, but nine of these leaders were in this picture. And below the Palestinian Authority. And by the way, I don't mean to impugn the integrity or political will of any of the Palestinian Authority people. My point here is a structural one, that they are put into a position where they are compelled to act like a Bantustan authority. From the point of view of the dominant state, the main function of this authority is to repress dissent, which in the top picture you see the Bantustan armed forces, in the lower part you see the Palestinian armed forces doing exactly that, maintaining the Bantustan through proxy measures. The Oslo Accords, we don't have time to get into this. I wrote a separate article about this, though, because I found it fascinating. The Oslo Accords established the Palestinian Authority on terms almost identical to the South African Bantustan constitutions, blow by blow. If you put those next to each other, you find almost exactly the same arrangements. And it's interesting that the ANC perceived this as a trap, rejected it from the beginning, and refused to have anything to do with it. And in fact, I understand Nelson Mandela told Arafat, bad idea, don't go for this, this is not a good idea, and they went for it anyway. So, in short, the PIA is now locked into being this self-government authority, and it cannot act independently of that role. The alternative, therefore, is if the partition can only sustain apartheid, and we must rethink the conflict on using South Africa not as a model but as inspiration or kind of a thought experiment. They called it colonialism of a special type. It doesn't involve agreeing and admitting that a large population of people has come in and indigenized, has settled, is not going to go away. Call it settler colonialism, shift the model from a colonial to a settler colonial model. And that means that you do not end it by partition you can't end settler colonialism and its power by partition. You have to end it by eliminating settler domination. Treating Palestine as a multinational state is on the basis of race would only perpetuate a settler discourse. because it is Zionism that has proposed that there are these identities that then if you recognize them and institutionalize them, you're essentially perpetuating apartheid. Treat the whole country as one country, Palestine, wrongly divided by race. This was the South Africa formula. It's one country wrongly divided by race. This means reunifying mandate Palestine. I'm out of time, aren't I? How am I doing? Okay. There is a legal basis for doing this. If we turn back to the League of Nations mandate, it always proposed that it was one country for everyone who lived there, that it would not be a Jewish state or anybody's state. It would be a secular democratic state. So there's a nice, fat, legal argument to explore there. The hard part of this is that reunification does raise very serious questions of identity shifts to reconstruct the idea of the nation, reconstruct the idea of the groups. In this case, Palestine would stop being a foggy mandate reference or a dreamy future, but it would be one state that belongs to all who live in it. It would not be the exclusive geographic heritage of any one part of the population. It would not require the departure or exclusion of anybody, which is tough for people who have lost a great deal to it. Jewish has to be reconceived as an ethnic group with full civil, social, and cultural rights, not a people with superior rights to the land, not as a nation with rights to self-determination. And Palestinian, this is the toughest thing for me to say as a non-Palestinian, but it returning to the idea that it is a multi-sectarian identity, it still is, actually, embracing everyone in mandate territory, not Arab in any sense that would exclude non-Arabs. Okay, this is one of the problems that Palestinian became Palestinian-Arab state. And under conditions of settler colonialism, you can't do that without excluding non-Arabs, and therefore, unfortunately, that has to be rethought deeply. Not the racial ethnic construction affirmed by Zionism and imposed by apartheid. So that's why the apartheid finding recasts everything. That's why so many people don't want to tackle it. I think it is crucial. I think it illuminates where we are and what is going on, and the more I look at it, the more powerful an analysis I think it is, and I do hope you will consider it seriously as a model for rethinking the conflict. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Virginia Tilley, who will now be followed by Palestinian attorney and professor at George Mason University, Nora Erekat.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you to all of you. I think you are very brave to come to this session, which focuses on law, which in and of itself is meant to be obscurist in order to disempower people to take their lives into their own hands, and by its very definition is indeterminate. So what we believe the law to proclaim is going to be subject to our own mediation as well as judicial interpretation. So anything on its face that the law tells us can be subject to some sort of legal controversy depending on who the lawyer is representing. So I really appreciated Dr. Tilley's presentation, but if my client were Israel, I could use the very same legal framework to come to a very different conclusion, which is why our reliance on law has to come with a great deal of skepticism and with a strategic vision. With that in mind, I want to build on what was said earlier to discuss occupation law and the way that occupation law has not failed to stem the proliferation of settlements and settlers within the West Bank and in Gaza until 2005, but instead, without occupation law, Israel could not have and could not continue to expand and entrench its settler colonial presence within the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, and frankly, throughout Mandate Palestine. So quick note on framework. Dr. Tilley walked us through apartheid and said that this would recast how we envision this to now think of it as settler colonialism. I want to urge us to think of this as settler colonialism first, project that's distinct from colonization in that the settler who travels into the colony is traveling with their sovereignty with an intent to stay. That intent to stay in the colony and to assert their sovereignty also places an imperative to remove the native. And so that there are two processes at play. There is the removal of the native with the intent to replace them with the settler and to establish a continuous, uninterrupted temporal and spatial presence. And this is from Patrick Wolf's Logic of Elimination. So that the Nakba and the removal of the settler, of the Palestinians, isn't an event, but becomes an ongoing Nakba, as Palestinians have referred to it, but also fits in this theoretical framework. If then we begin with settler colonization as the framework, apartheid and occupation become two legal regulatory regimes that enable and fulfill those settler colonial ambitions of removal and replacement. So Dr. Tilley discussed one approach, I'll discuss occupation. I'm not sure how this works, but here's the map that you may be familiar with. Obviously, Israel never defined its borders. These are the 1949 armistice lines established in March that have never been declared in order to facilitate expansion. When Israel conquered the territories in 1967, 90% of Israelis polled wanted to maintain them, mostly for religious reasons, with having an affectionate relationship to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. But that religious relationship had no political legitimacy, and therefore Israel had no basis to remain and was compelled to actually withdraw. But Israel wanted the territories, wanted to get around the law, and again, as what was mentioned, how do you get through that elevator, wanted to get around the law. It couldn't annex the territories, even if it wanted to, because of the prohibition on annexation, which comes into disrepute in the late 18th century. Up until then, territorial conquest was permitted. But it also, let's say that it didn't care about the laws we've seen in its annexation of Jerusalem and otherwise. It didn't want to annex the territory because it would have to absorb the Palestinian population, thereby disrupting a Jewish demographic majority that had been established in the aftermath of the Nakba and the removal of 800,000 Palestinian natives. So how then? And if it recognized the territory as occupied, it would have to revert the territory to its sovereign and maintain the territorial, demographic, and political status quo. So here's the problem. It wants the land, but it doesn't want the people on the land. If it annexes the land, it absorbs the population. If it doesn't annex the land and acknowledges occupation, it has to give the land back. So instead, Israel creates a new category in law known as, and declares that this occupation is sui generis, or distinct and unlike any other category, and argues that because Jordan's annexation of the West Bank in 1950 is not recognized by anyone besides Britain and Pakistan, and Egypt is only in authority of the Gaza Strip, and Palestinians don't exist as a people, that the territories belong to no sovereign. As such, occupation law as enshrined by the Hague Regulations, the Fourth Geneva Convention, as well as customary law, cannot be triggered. There is a sovereign void. This is not occupation by law, but shall be an occupation by fact. What does that allow Israel to do? It allows it the legal right to have presence in the territories without the legal obligation to maintain the status quo ante until the reversion of sovereignty. What does that allow for Israel? It allows it to incrementally take the land under two legal fictions, the legal fiction of military necessity and the legal fiction of temporality. As far as military necessity is concerned, the idea is that it is taking the land in order to create military encampments, and that all of the civilian presence is temporary. Obviously, that's a contradiction on its face, because you don't place civilians in a military encampment, otherwise you're using your own civilians as human shields, or it is in fact permanent. That is the first, legal fiction. The second legal fiction of temporality is what Meir Shamgar, the military advocate general and then chief justice for the Israeli High Court for two decades, describes as temporality. It's a temporary presence of the civilians, but it is not, which is indefinite, which is the opposite of permanent. Meaning that it is not permanent, but we do not have to declare an end to it, and that is the opposite of permanency, and therefore can be temporary. That is a legal fiction. But these legal fictions survive, because the law in and of itself, and especially international law, lacking a hierarchical adjudication system, lacking a reliable enforcement model, become subject to the political will of the international community and therefore can vary by application, implementation, and interpretation as it does here. The United States is central to this interpretation. And it's central to this interpretation despite the fact that it has its sub-administrations from the Johnson administration to the present, well, not this administration, have recognized that occupation law applies as a matter of law, not fact, and Israel is actually an occupying power, but has failed to implement its own interpretation of law for two reasons. One is, in the aftermath of the 1967 war, the Johnson administration determined the value of Israel as a Cold War asset in the Middle East as it vied with the Soviet Union to fill the power vacuum left by the European colonial powers. In that struggle to fill the power vacuum, what it decided and inaugurated after 1967 was a policy of ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge over any single one of its neighbors or collection of its neighbors so that it could prevail in a military confrontation should it arise. That's policy one. Before that, the United States had maintained a stalemate policy of equally arming Israel and its allied Arab monarchical regimes. So qualitative military edge. The second policy that it inaugurates, and this is another piece of this framework of why this sui generis occupation works, is that the Johnson administration also inaugurates and helps to orchestrate the Land for Peace framework, which is enshrined in UN Security Council Resolution 242. At the time that Israel occupies these territories, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the UN is in session and is in agreement that Israel is an occupying power and should withdraw. If, in fact, its attack on Egypt's Air Force, which had lain barren in the Sinai Peninsula and which was destroyed in 2 hours, if that initial attack was unprompted, then Israel has committed aggression, which is use of force that is illegal, and therefore has the legal obligation to withdraw without preconditions. If instead that was a preemptive use of force or self-defense, then Israel has the right to remain as an occupying power, but under no circumstances to assert title or territorial conquest. Why does this matter? In the drafting of the Security Council resolution, Johnson personally himself wanted to ensure that Israel can maintain the territories as consideration for exchange in exchange with the Arab states for permanent peace as part of a contractual agreement. Johnson was senator during Eisenhower's administration when Eisenhower forced Israel, France, and the UK to withdraw from the Suez Canal. And so this, and Johnson thought at the time, Israel should have been allowed to maintain the Egyptian territory and hold on to it until Egypt agreed to normalize its relationship with it and to establish a permanent peace. Here in 1967, the opportunity arose again, and rather than apply international law and withdrawal as a legal obligation, instead it becomes reformulated as a political equation of a quid pro quo exchange of land when you give us peace. In the negotiations, there was disagreement Israel wanted to keep it. So there was disagreement about which territories were to be withdrawn from. And the debate then raged about the terms of withdrawal, of immediacy, what would come first, withdrawal or peace. There was one other piece of the debate, which was the armistice lines as being tenuous and not being the permanent lines. The Johnson administration, as well as the UK, urge that the definite article, the, be dropped from the resolution in order to permit negotiation on the permanent borders, but never, ever to actually change the territorial integrity. And so here is one. There were five draft resolutions at the time. This is the Latin American bloc resolution. You could see in every other draft resolution, besides the one that's ultimately presented by the United Kingdom that becomes the language of 242, the definite article, the, all the territories, is included. The U.S. votes for this, by the way. It doesn't pass because there's disagreement about the sequence of withdrawal or peace. This is the final resolution. This is actually 242. You'll see that the definite article is dropped. But in the preambular text, there's the prohibition on the acquisition of territory by war. In the actual clause itself, it's stipulated that it was occupied in recent conflict. We know that legal loopholes are coming. And state after state, including France, argue that this is to be understood as allowing for minor border modifications. But Abba Iban, who represents Israel to the UN during this time and is quite exceptional in his skills, explains very forthrightly, the resolution means what it says and does not mean what it does not say. Another legalese that becomes consequential to this present day, together with Israel's own logic of what it would need to establish permanent borders, this one articulated by Deputy Prime Minister Igal Alon, who argues that defensible borders would be tantamount to this. As you could see, all of the orange is what Israel defines as what its defensible borders would look like. And what would be necessary for security purposes, there is Jerusalem is part of that plan. There is continuity between the interior of Israel as well as its border with Jordan. It controls almost the entirety of the eastern border. This is what it wanted articulated in 1967. It is achieved far more than that. It is achieved far more than that into the present. So let me just also add here that this could not be possible to the present without Palestinian participation and acquiescence, as embodied and represented through the peace process that's inaugurated in 1993. The Oslo Accords themselves, Dr. Tilley referred that we should compare them to apartheid plans. I would urge you to compare them to the 1978 Middle East peace process framework established by Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that articulates a framework of autonomy without sovereignty. And it is verbatim. A replication of that document that never envisioned a state. A state was never part of the negotiations. And this outcome is not because the law didn't work. It's because the law has worked perfectly well and very effectively that we have this outcome. How does that work? So here are the three parts. Israel is claiming that it is a sui generis occupation, therefore it has no legal obligation to apply occupation law, including the prescription on civilian settlement and captured or encapsulated by Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, also tantamount to a war crime. And under their presence, they can both take the land under military necessity and remain there under the legal fiction of temporality. Then, why can they change the borders and not maintain the 1967 border? Because under Security Council 242, the resolution doesn't specify, it says withdrawal from territories, but doesn't specify from which territories. because of the lack of the definite preposition. And three, this would have totally failed as a legal argument because it does not withstand any judicial scrutiny and has been rejected by the International Court of Justice, by the International Criminal Court, by the UN Security Council, as we've seen most recently in UN Security Council 2334, as well as by multiple human rights organizations, but nevertheless remains valid as a legal argument because of the third prong, which is the U.S. provision of political immunity and support, despite its own policy imperatives, because it doesn't want to apply sanctions on Israel because that would diminish its qualitative military edge, and it doesn't want to apply international law as a matter of that would dictate the outcome because that would actually diminish Israel's negotiating hand in negotiations. And so those three parts together reinforcing create this outcome today, which has where Israel has taken the land but not taken the people and has enabled it to remove the Palestinians, to concentrate them and to dispossess them onto these plots of land. This scenario that we see in the West Bank very vividly also exists in the Gaza Strip, but even there it's a very large concentration, and it too has been reduced in size the last time in 2014 by expanding the buffer zone by 40%. And if I had the map, which I do not, of Israel proper, we can see the concentration of Palestinians. Similarly, I think it was the first zone that Dr. Tilley pointed out to you, both in the Galilee region, which is the highest concentration of Palestinian citizens of Israel, or natives, essentially, as well as in the Negev. The concentration of Palestinians in the Negev is what is driving Israel today to remove those Palestinians forcefully, approximately 70,000 Palestinians, to place them into, concentrate them into urban townships, remove from their agricultural livelihoods, and to build an Israeli settlement within Israel in their place in order to disrupt their ability to return or have a claim of that return, fully fitting within a settler colonial framework, which is what we are marching towards. And in fact, by defunding UNRWA, what we're doing is diminishing the idea is to make them indistinct from the rest of the Arab population so that they can be absorbed elsewhere in surrounding countries, and therefore further diminish the demographic threat, so to speak, and further the idea of establishing Israel's Jewish settler sovereignty to be uncontested. That settler sovereignty to this day remains contested because of the demographic balance, and within Israel it remains an active frontier. There are other settler colonies in the world. Israel is not unique for this. The United States is a settler colony. What we see going on in the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually the removal of natives and taking away of their lands and obscuring the fact that they exist as a people and perpetuating a myth that the natives have disappeared in very similar ways that we perpetuate the myth of disappearance of Palestinians and their indistinct nationality with surrounding Arab countries. Thank you.
That was George Mason University professor and Palestinian attorney Nora Erekat. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.